This is Keeping the Faith on the Mormon Faircast. I'm your host, Bill Real. The Keeping the Faith series explores ways in which our faith can be challenged and ways in which we can overcome those challenges. Today on the Mormon Faircast, I sit down with Matt Frankham. This is part one of a two-part episode. In part one, we discuss his difficult childhood, his rebellion as a young man, his mission, and his deconstruction of his faith. He discusses his encounter with polygamy in the church's early history, and a tragic event in his life that made polygamy hit home. We discuss his removing himself and his family into inactivity and complete disbelief. He ends part one describing the lowest moment of his journey, but please tune in for part two and his return to faith.
Matt Frankham, welcome. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you. I'm excited to be here with you.
Excellent, excellent. Why don't you start off by introducing yourself to my listeners?
My name is Matt Frankham. I am 40 years old. I have two children and a wonderful wife, and I am a dermatologist PA living in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Wonderful, excellent. Well, why don't we start off the interview by you telling us a little bit about your childhood and your growing up?
Just maybe a little bit of background on my family. So on my father's side, we go way back in the church. So there was a guy named Benjamin Franklin Johnson, or B.F. Johnson. He is my four greats grandfather, and he was apparently a very good friend of the Prophet Joseph's. He at one time served as a secretary to him, and also was I wasn't aware of this organization, but he was a member of the Council of the 50 to Joseph
awesome.
Smith. And then on my other side, my mother's side, there's a less of a maybe orthodox ancestry. My mother has two grandparents that were professional artists, and somehow they met each other. They were both converts, and I'm the offspring of maybe an artistic side through her.
Excellent, excellent. Hey, you mentioned that your fourth great-grandfather was a member of the Council of 50, and from time to time we'll hear about that in the church, because in that Council of 50 it was, I think, stated that Joseph Smith was ordained to be a king, if I'm not mistaken. Is that something that your family was aware of?
Not at all. Not
okay,
even
gotcha.
A little bit.
Gotcha. So tell us a little bit about growing up.
All right. So I was raised in a very traditional Mormon household, also in Salt Lake City. We're pretty close to where I live now. And my parents, if you think of the most conservative people that you've ever known, that probably would be a good picture painted for my parents. And so I grew up in this household. And maybe if it's okay, I can just kind of illustrate what sort of the atmosphere was like in the family with a quick story.
Excellent.
So my parents, they grew up in the 60s, and they were in high school during the mid-60s and later 60s during the civil rights movement. You know, when I was getting really interested in music, you know, I'm getting into the Beatles and maybe the Beach Boys and some of the other bands popular in the 60s, I was really excited to talk to my parents about their experiences during this time. And when I went to kind of asked my dad, excited about kind of the stories that he would tell. Apparently at the time I was pretty naive and idealistic. Maybe I was 12, 13 at the time. I wasn't quite up with my history, Salt Lake City history, and I didn't realize that Salt Lake wasn't quite the a central hub of the civil rights movement. But I asked my dad, I said, what was it like growing up during this time? And he kind of mentioned, or I don't know, even maybe smugly, said, I didn't really even notice. I was just too busy. And I kind of felt like that was kind of a teaching moment for him, for me, teaching me that there are two different types of people. There are those that work hard for a living, and then there are those that are more willing to accept handouts. And he made it known to me that he thought that those that were involved in that era, maybe, you know, protesting and with the environment and, you know, the stereotype hippie, they were people that looked for a handout. And just, I think that he was a workaholic. He worked 60 hours a week, and he would come home and work on the weekends just for good measure. And he expected us to work every weekend. Every Saturday was not only a day to get ready for Sunday, as the song goes, but it was definitely a day to work with Dad.
Gotcha. So you guys got a lot of things done.
We did, definitely.
Okay. Excellent. What was your dad like growing up? I mean, I know you're talking about him being kind of splitting people into dichotomy. There's those who work really hard and those who don't. How was he in the home?
Well, he was a black and white thinker, as I intimated, and we were very devout. We went to church every single week. We had home evening every Monday, and we read our scriptures in the morning. And if we didn't like it, there were consequences. And, you know, he probably was, well, I should say that I kind of found out over time that he wasn't as gentle as maybe some parents. When I was comparing notes with my friends, I realized that my friends, maybe at age 10, 11, they weren't getting the belt. And, you know, my dad really espoused and believed in corporal punishment. So, you know, there was a lot of, I don't know, I guess I look at it now as sometimes I really deserved what I got, but, you know, it was very disturbing watching my brother get the belt across the back, and some of the things that I saw with my siblings were even more difficult than some of the things that I had happened to me. I think the most memorable time, memorable in a bad way, was once when my brother had mentioned that he did not want to listen to these old fogies anymore, and that we were watching General Conference, and my dad was, he gave him quite a good beating.
Gotcha. Was your mom a stay-at-home mom?
She was. She was a very traditional mom, and she was a good mom. I sometimes was a little bit upset at her, maybe just because I felt like she should do more to kind of protect us from my father.
I find life to be strange, and I don't want to delve off too many times and kind of share my stories. I want the interview to be about the things that happen in your life, but I have a grandfather who's passed away now who grew up in the Great Depression, and he had 8 kids, my dad being one of them, and he was a very rough guy. He'd come home at night from the bar after drinking quite a bit. He would beat his kids. He would, if they did something wrong, he would chase them down. They'd hide underneath the bed, but he'd grab a broomstick and swat them out from underneath there, and he was a really rough guy. But I think sometimes we look at our fathers or other people in our life who have that kind of personality, and it's easy for people who are listening to your story or listening to me share this story to pass judgment or to think ill of these folks. But at the same time, they grew up in a whole different set of circumstances with different experiences. And while the things they did certainly aren't approved, I'm sure you have a great love for your father as well.
I do. And I think being able to look and see the environment that he grew up in, you know, my grandfather, his father, was in World War II. My father didn't even meet him until I think my dad was about 2 or 3 years old. And
wow.
Apparently my dad's reaction to meeting my grandfather was crying and running away. And can you imagine, you know, coming home from serving your country and having your child run away from you in fright? I just can't imagine what that did to kind of his psyche.
What was your spirituality like in your early childhood or as a youngster?
I remember the most vivid memory that I have of spirituality is my baptism. I had an incredible baptism. I got hurt really severely right the day of my baptism, and I got a blessing so that I was jumping on a trampoline. You know, trampolines were just the biggest thing right then in the late 70s, early 80s, and I'd hurt my leg horribly, and I got a blessing from my uncles, and I went through with the baptism, even though I really couldn't walk. They helped me in, and I remember that being the most spiritual experience when I was a kid, and I kind of held on to that for a while, just kind of giving me strength through some of those times when it was really tough with my dad.
Moving through your childhood, obviously getting through into high school, what was high school like, and where did you go from there?
So I developed a love for the arts. I developed, I guess, a talent in painting and drawing. And when I was in, I think 14, I did my first commission for people, painting portraiture. And so I was very artistic. And then I started to play guitar. I learned how to play the guitar. And I think that this was really hard for my dad. I remember him a couple times looking at me painting and just shaking his head, saying, you know, this is not going to allow you to make a good living, you know, just maybe you should be focusing on other things. And so I don't think my dad and I really connected on any level. And it was, I think that because of that, and of course the problem with corporal punishment, I really started to resent him. And I saw him as being synonymous with the church. I saw him as being one and the same as the gospel of Jesus Christ after my baptism and getting into my teens. And pretty soon, I just didn't really want anything to do with the church. I think it was my 16th birthday when I just, I kind of learned to be physical. I'd learned to fight. And finally, I was big enough to kind of stand up to him. And I think I learned to be physical from him. And so I think in my 16th birthday, I was big enough to tell him no. And under no circumstances was I going to go to church anymore.
From the age of 16 on through high school, you didn't attend church at all?
No, I didn't. I never went to seminary. I never went to young men's. I never had any exposure. And I think even for a few years before age 16, I had checked out pretty much. I refused to do much. My dad and I were at loggerheads a lot, and that was one way that I could kind of prove my displeasure with how I felt he treated me. And I stopped going to church pretty early on. And I think at age 16, I bought a Volkswagen camper bus, and my goal was to drive across country and see all the sights with a friend. And I started to paint, I attempted to paint Grateful Dead motifs all over it. And I think my dad felt like this was a direct assault on his values, and maybe, as I look at it now, probably more concerned about how it might look to our very conservative Mormon neighbors. So he put a stop to that, and again, I wasn't endeared to him for that.
I know you mentioned that you had come to kind of associate the way in which your dad behaved or acted or treated you to be equal with the way the church conducted itself. And I just think this is an important thing for my listeners to kind of grasp at, because I think for a lot of us, when we get into, and as you share later on, your faith crisis, a lot of us tend to get into places where we kind of set up some false paradigms where we think the church is one thing when it's actually something else. And then when we come to find out it's that something else, we're almost set up for the fall. And when you mentioned that your dad equaled the church, it really touched me hearing you say that, because me and my son have the same kind of conversations. We just had one the other day coming home from church where I tried to explain to him that all of my flaws and shortcomings are not representative at all of the gospel. That the gospel is this beautiful, wonderful thing that makes our lives better, and that I'm simply a human being who's flawed and has severe weaknesses, and asked him at that point to never ever measure the church by me. And so I just thought it was interesting that here you are kind of talking about the same idea, that you had kind of had this feeling that dad equaled the church. And I think for listeners, it's important to know that one example that really doesn't represent the gospel really shouldn't be compared to the gospel, and that we should be allowed to have flaws.
Even if that example is your father, biological father, I agree with you completely. I think also, Bill, you're a bishop, and my dad also was in leadership positions always, either in the bishopric or in the high council. So I think that was another reason that I kind of saw him as representing the church.
If he can have the kind of behavior that he has and still be a leader within the church, then the church must be okay with that behavior and think that that is essentially status quo.
I think that's exactly...
When in reality, we all have our own lives away from the three-hour block on Sunday.
You're exactly right. That is exactly how I felt, right?
You've gotten kind of through high school. You've become inactive. What did you do after high school?
So I started attending the University of Utah, pretty close by my home. I took a class. I think all freshmen are required to take American history, and I took American history as well. And I met a professor, Professor Moss, Dr. Moss, and he I have no better way to put it than he sort of changed my whole paradigm as to what a Mormon male acts like, looks like, and values. I just thought that I don't think I was exposed as much as I could have been as a teenager to different types of approaches to my faith in terms of, you know, it just seemed like everyone that I knew in my neighborhood were just such conservative people. They just, I didn't know that even a Mormon male could have any interest in the arts. I just, and maybe that was just where I grew up. I'm not sure, but this guy, I absolutely fell in love with him. Him and I just connected. He was very interested in the arts. Of course, he was in the humanities with his professorship in history, and we talked about history. We talked about music. We talked, you know, he was just, I could tell that he knew that I was a troubled teen, and he took the time to kind of mentor me. And I think I remember being shocked when he told me he was a member of the church. I didn't think that many of the professors at the U were Mormons, because I thought that maybe they kind of acted, the U of U acted as a counterbalance in the community to BYU, and I just assumed that, well, since that was my impression, that all of the professors would be not LDS. Anyway, I really had a great relationship with him, and I introduced him to Pink Floyd, and he was he acted interested anyway, and he introduced me to Walt Whitman and William Wordsworth, and I really adored him. I loved him.
It sounds like, in some ways, he was almost the antithesis of your dad.
You know, he was, and he was so warm, and you know, I think, not to go back too much with my dad, but I think if my dad, if he had shown, if he were to punish me for the kind of the, and I was a stinker, I'll admit, you know, I was a rambunctious young man, but if he would have just shown me a little bit of increased love after the punishment, I think it would have all been better.
I guess what I'm getting at too is that your dad's kind of looks like, seems like this a black and white thinker, very strict, very by the book, and here you've got this professor who's much more liberal, much more open to different viewpoints and interesting things going on within culture. It just kind of seems like there was a big difference there. Did it open up your world or open up your view again of the LDS Church?
It allowed me to take a second look. So we kind of talked a little bit about the history of the church, and I don't know exactly if it was him that introduced me to a simple book about the history of the church and Joseph Smith's life, but it was called Truth Restored, and I'm not positive if it's even in print, but I read that from cover to cover. It's a quick read. You can read it in a few hours, and I think, you know, it's hard for me to remember exactly, but I just think I felt a peace or a calmness about me with reading that. I had a little more interest in learning more about the doctrine. I really did not know much about the church at that time. I hadn't attended seminary, so I was learning on my own, and I picked up a Gospel Principles book and just kind of read it through, and I think I was about I was 19 or 20, and I you know, it was obvious that all my peers had left on missions, and it was time to sort of decide if this thing was really true. And if I hadn't gained much gospel knowledge from my upbringing, I certainly learned how to pray. I think I commend my parents for really focusing on that, and I knew how to pray. And I prayed at that time whether I should go on a mission, and I felt a peace and a calm, and even though it wasn't a mind-blowing spiritual experience, I decided to go.
You know, just maybe just a side note for my listeners, the book Truth Restored is an awesome book, and I don't know if you know this or not, Matt, but it was written by President Hinckley before he was president of the church.
You know, I do know that. I remember seeing that, and I've always had a soft spot in my heart for him, even before he was president. I always would seek out his talks and listen to him specifically. So yeah, he was great in that book.
Yeah, and I also know that we use a book in Sunday school from time to time, especially this year, like when we're going through the Doctrine and Covenants, which is called Our Heritage. And I always wondered why we didn't use the Truth Restored book instead, only because I think it's just like Our Heritage, but it's a very concise book, right on with the history. It gives a great background. It's a book that I've used many times and got a couple copies on my shelf. So I just joined with you maybe in encouraging our listeners, if they're interested, they can still pick it up through the LDS online store. It is still in print, and I think it's only $2 or so a copy. But it's a wonderful book that shaped me as well as it sounds like it shaped you.
Yeah, no, it was definitely something that I believe I felt the spirit with reading.
Going from there, you talk about your friends leaving on a mission. Did you serve a mission?
Yeah, so I did. I got called to the Portland, Oregon mission, and the first year of my missions, since I was really behind. I was behind with gospel knowledge. I was behind, I think, spiritually. But the one thing that I had going for me is I was, I think, a little more mature. I left at almost age 21, and my experience in the MTC was I had not embarrassingly read the Book of Mormon, and also embarrassingly, I really did not even know that the whole point of the book is that it was Christ coming to America to be a second witness.
Right, right. Which, you know, seems unusual because growing up in the church, it would seem almost impossible for you to get by not knowing that. But somehow you made it there without knowing that the Savior had visited the Americas. Your first time reading through the Book of Mormon, was it... Yeah, I have this vision of everybody who goes on a mission is kind of forced to read the Book of Mormon as fast as humanly possible. Was that kind of the way it was for you going through it?
No, I really didn't feel pressured. I read every free moment. The district in my MTC, they called me Parley. They nicknamed me Parley just because I would bring it everywhere and read it everywhere. And I coupled with the spirit of the place and not knowing, you know, the stories in it, I just really fell in love with it and I had an amazing experience in the MTC.
Awesome. So what kind of mission did you have?
The first year, it was tough. I don't think I was able to forget my old friends, my artist friends, and they would send me letters and talk to me about worldly things, and I just wasn't able to forget myself. And it wasn't until my second year that I really settled down, and like a lot of missionaries, I think this is a pretty common theme among missionaries, was able to completely just lose themselves in the work, and I did that, and I feel like it was that time when I truly gained an understanding of what it meant to be a disciple of Christ. I'd kind of forgotten about my dad, and he no longer represented the church to me. I saw it for what it was. I remember having spiritual experiences about Christ, and I think because I was engaged in the work, I just was able to forget about kind of a rough upbringing, and for lack of maybe a more a proper word, the hate for my dad that I had before my mission.
Gotcha. What's the one thing you took away from your mission?
Selfless service is ultimately the source of happiness.
Awesome. You know, there's two things that people always bring up when I ask that question. It's one, it's the learning of selfless service, and the other is the love of the people. And it just amazes me of the hundreds of missionaries that I've had chances to talk to and to speak with. It's always one of those two things that they tend to focus on as the thing they took away. So coming back home from your mission, what happened then?
Well, I had kind of gained an interest on my mission in medicine. I remember the last few months really thinking hard about what I wanted to do when I got home, so I didn't waste any time. Within the first week of coming home, I started school at the University of Utah, and I had to make a decision between going to the Y, which was certainly my first choice. With my newfound dedication to the gospel, I wanted to be around like-minded people. And I'd heard stories about the U that sometimes the professors can be a little anti-Mormon, and maybe if not overtly, then certainly covertly, and they like to shock the naive Mormons. And the U of U has the only medical program in the area, and so I decided that would be the place that I would go. And I spent the next 8 years in my undergraduate and graduate work there at the University of Utah.
You going through school, I mean, was college tough? Were you focused on grades? I mean, what was college like
for
you?
Yeah, college was, I had decided that when I got home that in order to succeed in my goal of becoming, if not an MD, then what I ultimately became was a PA, that I would have to give every effort, both maybe cognitively as well as all of my time to this endeavor. So I kind of embarrassingly maybe took a step away from full engagement in my ward and in full efforts, holding a calling. I remember thinking that I maybe shied away a little bit from participating in class and being a little bit more taciturn, as it were. But I think that did not people around me didn't necessarily think that this guy is a dynamic guy. And I think by taking a step backwards, I knew that that I would not be given a difficult calling. I knew that I wasn't going to be given, you know, Elders Quorum President, and I was really nervous that it would take away from my full effort in what I felt was a very worthwhile altruistic goal of becoming a doctor or a PA. So I didn't serve as faithfully as I could, and I think that I paid the price.
What were your grades like? Were your grades good in school?
I did not get anything less than an A minus. I was really focused on becoming. It sounds so ridiculous now, but I wanted the title of either magna cum laude or summa cum laude or one of those. I guess that it just really appealed to me, and I thought that would really help me stand out in my application to medical school.
In the ward that we're in, we live near a hospital that takes in medical students. About every year or two, we get three or four families that come in, each of the husbands or the wife being a medical student. And it seems to never fail that out of that group, you'll have, you know, one or two that have their priority in the church. Sometimes their grades will suffer just a little bit, but they tend to find ways to make it all work. And then there'll always be one or two in that group who are extra focused on the education part. That's where their priority is. And I think it's really easy to sit back and to judge them and to say, you know, I wish these folks would serve more in the church. And obviously it is good for them to do that. I mean, it's on a level of spirituality. But at the same time, too, I think members of the church got to also be a little more understanding of these folks and the pressure that's on them and the amount of money they've borrowed and the things that are going on with time, the years you spend going to school, especially when it's in the medical field. You talk about being there for 8 years and maybe be a little more sympathetic to some of the stresses that they're feeling as well, which sounds like maybe some of that you were feeling as well, although obviously you're accepting full accountability for kind of backing away from the church.
Oh, for sure. And I recognize now, you know, I did not, I would have been fine with B's. I did, for some reason, you know, I kind of feel like I had this value instilled in me as a youth. And, you know, I was a workaholic and my dad was a workaholic and I wanted him to be proud of me. And I always remember, you know, Dad, you know, look at what I'm doing here. And expecting him to really show how proud he was. And I think that there was some motivation there, but, you know, I do also remember, interestingly, that I finals were always right after Thanksgiving, and for 5, 6, maybe even the full 8 years, I didn't even spend Thanksgiving with my family. I just locked myself away, and anyway, that's kind of an illustration of kind of how I had been sort of conditioned for this sort of thing.
Gotcha. So you distance yourself from the church, from your family, with perhaps placing the reason on that being your schooling, but also maybe that was kind of and I don't want to use the word excuse, but a way to kind of allow you to back off from those things.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'd also add, I wanted my dad to be proud of me.
Sure, absolutely. Moving from there, I know, you know, talking to you and kind of looking over how we wanted this interview to go, that at some point here, not too long after, you meet the one that you fall in love with and marry. Would you mind sharing that part of the story with us?
Absolutely, because that's a very happy time. My wife was also at the University of Utah, and she was in pre-nursing classes. And so our interest in medicine kind of caused us to have interesting conversations in that direction. I attended a young single adult ward, and she did as well, that same one, and we ended up falling in love and getting married. We got married in the Salt Lake Temple. It's been a beautiful relationship.
How was your spirituality or her spirituality early on in the marriage? How were things I mean, when you get married, do you start going back to church, or are you still kind of the both of you staying distant? How does that all work out?
You know, and I probably should clarify, we never did stop going to church. But I think that you'll recognize that there's a way that a person can approach church. If you get up and bear your testimony and you're heartfelt and you comment, and, you know, those are the people that tend to get the hard callings. And if you don't do all that and you sit in the back and you don't talk in Sunday school, then you kind of are less engaged. The truth of the matter is you're less likely to have a difficult calling. So I think that's where I was more than not going to church. But so we were going to church. It was exciting for me to kind of share what I had learned from my mission with my wife. And I remember her not necessarily having the strongest testimony. She'd been a cultural Mormon and drew from the testimony of her parents and relatives, but she had never really truly read the Book of Mormon. And I don't think, as I look back, that she had much of a testimony of the Book of Mormon. You know, I was so focused on my schooling, it was just difficult for us to really seek out the extra activity that really makes membership in the church rich. Going to extra, I guess, the ward activities and really going out of your way to meet people in the ward and have them over. And we just didn't do any of that. And we ended up kind of having an interesting job. We would take care of elderly women in their basement, where we would live in the basement, both of us being in medicine. And this would allow them to stay in their home. We would get free rent and we would take care of them. And there was also a sort of a price to pay with that. We were always moving because it was at the end of their lives, and oftentimes they'd live less than a year after we moved in. And I think we counted 7 moves in 8 years when we were going to school at that time. And so that took a toll. We kind of had less incentive to get involved because we knew we would probably be moving in the next few months. And so, you know, over time, I think we just got less and less engaged and the ward, and I think that we stopped going. I think at first I stopped going to priesthood meeting, and then I had this experience where I was sitting in sacrament meeting, and I think there was maybe a 20-minute period where I just hadn't heard a word that was said from the speaker, and I had this realization and afterwards, and I said to myself, you know, what in the world are you doing? You could be studying, working a study group. When I was in the PA program, they always had the tests on Monday morning. And so the study groups were always Sunday during the afternoon. And this was the same time during church. And I just remember feeling just this sort of gnawing to be there. And I just remember, you know, maybe we should just take a break from church. It's for a good cause. I mean, this is my livelihood. This is a profession where I'll be helping people. I mean, it's sort of the story of rationalizing something good, something great with something only good. So I did that. I said to myself, you know what, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to take a 6-month period until I've graduated. I've done the boards. I've passed boards. And then I will start back in full activity. And I remember that sort of having that debate with myself during church. And so I did it. I stopped going to church.
You know, a lot of members do that, where they'll disengage from the gospel with the plan that they're going to re-engage with full intent as soon as something fixes itself, as soon as something improves, as soon as something is accomplished. And yet, almost to a T, that process is so much more difficult than they ever planned on it being. Was that how it was for you? I mean, where did your spirituality go from there, and did you come right back to church like you told yourself you would?
No, I didn't immediately. I graduated that 6 months later, and the plan was that I would graduate, I would get a good job, we would buy a home, and we would have a child, and all of those things happened. And then once we settled down where we weren't moving every few months, I would go to church and I would nourish my testimony, I would hold a calling, I would do everything that I knew I needed to do. When finally I had what I considered some free time in my life because I'd graduated, we got back going to church. Yeah, we did, but it wasn't the same. It just wasn't the same. I just did not have any sort of enthusiasm for the gospel. I recall that I hadn't had a temple recommend for a period of time, and my wife's sister was getting married, and I needed to re-up on this. So I got an appointment with the bishop. To my wife, was prodding me, of course. Couldn't miss this occasion. And I had no intention on leaving that interview without a temple recommend. But as he went through the questions, I just, and I don't think it necessarily happens this way with everybody, but I felt that I had to be completely authentic with myself. I had to be completely honest with him. And when he asked these questions, I really couldn't give a completely honest answer of yes. You know, believe that the 12 apostles, that the prophet, are called of God and represent Christ, and that the church is His true church, and these things. I just said, you know what? I'm sorry. I really can't. And I remember him just looking so sad and dejected. And I kind of tried to gather myself and just say, wait. You know, no. This isn't the end. I'm gonna come back. I'm gonna figure stuff out, and it'll be fine. And he was so genuine with me, and he said, okay, let's meet and let's figure this out. And the truth of the matter is, I left there, and I didn't meet with him. I think he called me to meet, and I just kind of I had a newfound freedom. I didn't have to go to school anymore, and I had found company with some old friends that I had previous to my mission. These were all artists that had more liberal views, and many of them, in fact, were even disaffected members of the church and members that had their name removed. And I'm not sure exactly, honestly, why it was that this group happened to have this dynamic. But it happened to make a huge impact on how I approached my spirituality and the Mormon Church.
One of the things that kind of interests me as you're telling this part of the story is this whole going into this interview and being confronted with the idea that there's things that you don't know. And I often think about sacrament meeting, especially testimony meeting, where we have members that walk up so easily and so often and say, I know this and I know that and I know these things with every fiber of my being. And I know, sitting there and watching testimony meeting occur, that there are members in that congregation who don't know, who perhaps only hope or perhaps only believe. And that's got to be tough to feel like whatever their testimony is, it's less than what it should be, when in reality, even to hope or to believe is an exercise of faith. Did you feel like not knowing put you in a place where you had no testimony at all? Or did you recognize that at least on some level, you at least hoped in those things?
No. Well, it didn't make me feel like I had no testimony at all, first of all. I felt like doubt was, you know, healthy. I had just had an experience at a university that doubting things leads to great things. I really don't feel like it's a problem not to be able to, with every fiber of my being, know something. I had just spent time at the university, and of course, doubting is the genesis of many wonderful developments. And doubting also allows us to come up with theories, and these theories allow us to explain the world around us. And maybe I had been maybe indoctrinated a little too much in the wisdom of man, but I certainly did not feel that doubting things was going to ultimately cause a problem. And nor do I think now that it really caused a problem. I think not nourishing my testimony, not feeding the positive spiritual experiences that one usually has when one is engaged in a ward family. That was the problem. It wasn't necessarily that I doubted, because, you know, doubting oftentimes leads to further light.
A beautiful way to put it. So this interview with the bishop, you walk away not being able to get a temple recommend. Well, first let me ask you this. Does this cause you to be frustrated at all with this bishop?
No. I mean, it frustrated my wife to no end, but I tried to, because she wanted me to be there with the rest of the family, and I wasn't. And I dropped her off, and I took a ride in the car and went and got her a few hours later. But I loved him. I knew that he, you know, he had just a love about him, and I wanted to do it just for him in a way, but I knew that I couldn't, and I wanted to, like I said, be completely honest with him, but it didn't get me frustrated. What it did do was allow me to reassess everything. Now, I mean, there was no one in the ward to impress. I mean, the bishop wasn't going to, I didn't have to, you know, impress him in any way, make him think I was something I wasn't. And so I just took two giant steps backwards because of that, not just a small step. I think that also I was really excited about having free time. I hadn't had any free time in so long that I just said, hey, you know what, let's take advantage of this. I think that there are a lot of return missionaries that do the exact same thing. They have a moment where they can just finally breathe, and it's as though they say, you know what, I'm just going to take a little break from spirituality for a time. And it's ultimately hurts their testimony. And this break that I took, I sought out the company of people that oftentimes had really negative things to say about the church. And they, I didn't really participate in some of the banter back and forth about, I guess, how ridiculous the church was. These people generally felt they were more sophisticated than and above religious and religiosity and the moral imperatives therein. So I got a good dose of that, and you know, I got a quick lesson in you are who you hang out with, and I started to, I guess, think more like they thought the more I hung out with them, and I spent more and more time away from my family. I was just exhilarated by the creative process was just so exhilarating to me. I just finally had an opportunity to paint again, and people were very complimentary, and I was selling paintings to people. Not that, you know, I was seeking or marketing these things, but, you know, they would come up and just say, hey, you know, I love that painting, I'd love to buy it from you. And I was flattered. I just thought, well, maybe this is my true calling in life. And so I spent more and more time with this, and spent more and more time going to exhibits and galleries. And it wasn't healthy on my marriage. And I had a child about the same time. I had my first child, my daughter, and I had a really unpredictable reaction to her birth. And I had thought that I had worked through all my problems, all the problems that I had with my dad on my mission. And I came home and, you know, I, for the first time, was able to hug him. And I might have even shed a few tears and said that I loved him. And I think he even told me that the same thing, which was maybe a first. But I had this reaction, and the reaction was this. I remember holding her in my arms and looking at her in her eyes, and just thinking, if my father loved me like I love this little being, how could he ever have treated me the way that he did? I never really felt loved. He never showed any empathy or interest in anything that I was doing, I thought. And then there was the problem with the corporal punishment. And I think that all of the images came back, flooding back, and I became, you know, very sour. I pushed him away. I wasn't interested necessarily in going over on Sundays like I had been doing, and I kind of wanted an explanation from him. I wanted to confront him and say, I love this person this much. How much did you love me? And why couldn't you have been the father that I needed? And so I didn't do that. I should have done something like that, I guess. But I just distanced myself. Again, the thought came to me that, you know, and I know it's crazy because of all the experiences that I was having, good experiences in the church on my mission, but that my father represented the church again. And I took another step backwards.
And I can completely, you know, empathize with that whole experience. It sounds like at this point the deck of cards are about to start falling. Would you mind kind of running us through how you got, you know, how you went through this faith crisis and where it took you?
Yeah. So I was watching a PBS special, you know, and I feel really bad. I recognize that I am not as linear thinking as I am more visceral and emotional. And so I didn't really find out the exact name, but I was watching a PBS special about Mormons, and I think it had the title of Brigham Young, the Moses, the American Moses, or the Moses of the West. In any event, it was going through some of the salient points of Mormonism, and it was talking about Brigham Young and polygamy, of course, as every good Mormon documentary should. It talked about a girl that was about 17, 18 years old that was dating a gentleman, maybe her age, and suddenly Brigham Young became very interested in her and wanted to have a polygamous relationship with her, and she was not excited about it, and he apparently convinced her parents that if she were to marry him, that she would be saved in heaven in the new and everlasting covenant. So I think where my testimony was at the time, this was quite shocking. I had for some reason, and I'm not sure exactly where it came from, but I do remember being taught somewhat by my dad and for sure on my mission that polygamy was not about sex. It was about women that were maybe, for whatever reason, didn't have prospects for marriage, maybe women that had been widowed, women that were, whatever reason, not able to take care of themselves, that it was a way for the church to take care of them. And when this came to light, I was shocked, and I wanted to make sure, I wanted to find out if that was true, and I started diving in a little more to it, and I found out a lot about polygamy, polyandry, and Joseph Smith. I think I'd had a, you know, I didn't really care to even find out before, I'll be honest with you. And this was tough. And at the same exact time, a sort of a bizarre thing happened. My cousin Elizabeth Smart was kidnapped. Her mom, Lois Smart, is my dad's sister. Her maiden name is Lois Frankham. And within a month of the capture of Brian David Mitchell, I'd read a book kind of surrounding the events of the kidnapping, and it was given to me just as an afterthought. I think someone had just finished reading it, and I didn't expect to read it, but one day I picked it up, and I kind of I learned that the perpetrator, the kidnapper, Brian David Mitchell, had a very, I guess, a thick history of temple work, and I think that it even made the connection that all the time that he spent in the temple probably contributed to his need to take on multiple wives. As deranged as he was, as crazy maybe as he was, I kind of thought, well, you know, it's the teachings of the church and polygamy that if there had never been that ridiculous aspect of our church history, there would never have been his desire to take on multiple young 14, 15-year-old girls and take them as wives. And I was just so angry about the whole situation. I was just so devastated that, you know, I just was ready to, among other aspects that were bothering me, this was one of the main ones. And I remember going to my wife and just saying, hey, you know what, this doesn't seem right. And I remember in a tongue-in-cheek way saying that, tell you know what, let's not be involved in the church. And I don't know exactly the wording, but I do remember saying that, you know, if we do leave the church, if we do decide to go inactive for what, that you won't have to have polygamy, and you won't have to share me after this life. There will be no sister wives, and we can be together, just you and I. And I think that this sort of resonated with her, and she was, you know, she was having some doubts as well. I would always share things with her, and she just wasn't, I don't think, at the time, a mature enough in her assessment to really think on her own at that point.
You know, a couple things here. It seems like three things kind of happened with this whole PBS and your cousin being kidnapped. First off, you learn about really the ins and outs of polygamy and polyandry for the first time, which I don't know that any member of the church is really prepared for when the full story really hits them, correct? I mean, do you feel
no,
the same way?
No, yeah, I felt like I'd been hit by, by a truck. I just remember we just sat there on the couch afterwards and just looked at each other.
And that's just it. I mean, polyandry and polygamy is such a, you know, on the surface, when we hear polygamy, no big deal. It was practiced in the Old Testament, so obviously it's a restoration and it needs to be practiced now. But when we understand the ins and outs of the emotional dynamics of how that principle is put into place, and you know, for those who believe it was sanctioned by God and those believe that it wasn't, really isn't pertinent to this discussion. It's more of an understanding that as this principle was put into place, that people had to make tough decisions and tough choices that were emotionally difficult and hard to do and took a toll on them. The other thing, too, is kind of going into this, it sounds almost like you had this assumption that prophets were these perfect people, and when Brigham Young acted the way he did and whatever information we're getting may be completely different than what the actual historical context was, but based on the information you're getting, that seems like it conflicted maybe with an inner feeling that would be behavior unbecoming of a prophet.
Yeah.
Would that be correct?
I really
too?
Wanted polygamy to be altruistic about helping the widowed and a 45-year-old spinster without any other prospects. I really truly wanted it to be about that, and I'd got bad information.
Right.
I understand now.
And then the last thing kind of is that as this happens with your cousin, all of a sudden this whole issue becomes extremely personal. And so now it's no longer dealing with somebody else who's has a problem, but now it's hitting home, which has to make it that much tougher to try and work through.
I was extremely, extremely angry. This was, as you can imagine, just very difficult on my family.
Dealing with this whole discovering of this issue, which sounds like it prompted you to then explore more and discover more issues. Did you run into the other things that most people do, seer stones, treasure digging, the church's stance on certain issues such as Africans in the priesthood, things? I mean, did you just kind of go down the slippery slope from here?
Yeah, I did. There's a popular radio station here in the Valley, and it's an NPR station, so I agree, it's pretty liberal. But they have a local show called Radio West, and they often have very controversial topics, and it introduced a lot of things regarding these other issues and the history of the church, some of the doctrine, and you know, I became quite enthralled with it, I admit, and it fueled the fire of wanting to distance myself from not only my ward, my church, my religion, but also my family. They weren't excited about what I was doing. I was taken aside by my father-in-law, and he looked me in the eyes and said, "This is not what we signed up for. You're taking away our daughter." They blamed me for this, and my mother was extremely angry, saying that I was ruining a family, a celestial family, and you know, that was not what I wanted to hear. And I just felt like, you know what, I just need to lay low for a while. I need to take some time to figure stuff out, I guess is the best way to put it. But that's what I told them anyway. In my mind, I was done with it.
So you went completely inactive.
I did, and I asked the bishop for no contact. I asked my wife to ask the Relief Society for no contact. And I know I sound like a domineering husband, and I really wasn't, but we had made this this decision together that we would be better off as a couple to not be involved in the church. And I explained to a very close friend and my brother my feelings, that I not only felt like the church wasn't true and that they'd lied to me, that I felt like it was actually tearing up our family. And so I was a little vocal, and I was maybe a little obnoxious about it. I remember maybe throwing out a few things that I'd learned to shock my family at times. And I understand from from certain websites that that's not an uncommon reaction.
You didn't only come to the conclusion that the church wasn't true, but you also decided that it was also destructive, and that you need to essentially back away from it and put some distance between you and the church.
And my family, and maybe especially my dad, yes.
How long were you inactive for?
You know, I was inactive for about 7 or 8 years. I became more and more involved with this group of friends that I guess acted maybe as a de facto support group for me. It was certainly a network of people that I could relate with on a creative level, but over time it was also maybe even a spiritual level in a different way. A lot of them kind of subscribe to more new age spirituality, Buddhism and humanism, things like that. And so I was attracted to some of the discussions that they had, that I could live my life and be a good person, that I could treat other people kindly, and that I could do all of this without a reward after this life on earth, that I could do it for no other reason other than the fact that I love my fellow being. And I remember being very attracted to that idea. That's the premise of humanism, and it appealed to me. But the truth of the matter is that I really was not a better person. I don't think this happens to everybody that goes this direction, but for myself, I recognize that I was less patient with people. I was less serving. I was not as good of a husband and a father. I didn't recognize it then necessarily, but I recognize it now.
And I think that's a great point to make, that we sometimes think that, well, like for instance, what you kind of made the comment was, is that I can still be a good human being without participating in the principles and ordinances of the gospel. And sometimes we think we can do that. And I am reminded of Elder Holland in his most recent conference address, where he said, I can envision many of you who step away from the church, and of course I'm paraphrasing, but having a lot of empty nets and a lot of lonely nights. And I don't know that we recognize where we're in the midst of that, but it certainly, I think, holds true that there's a lot of things in the gospel that bring us blessings that when we step away from, realizing it or not, they're not there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I did not feel the Spirit. I did not necessarily recognize that I wasn't feeling the Spirit, but I certainly had less motivation to be a selfless person. And even though I had told myself that I was going to do these things, ultimately I didn't. And I started doing some things that had the potential to be destructive to my family. I started to drink, and not that necessarily I feel that that's a huge problem with people that step away from the church. There's certainly worse things. But I was drinking very in a social manner. But I think more detrimental than that, I was attending sort of these parties or these events where I was with people that were so very negative towards the church. I can remember one occasion where I was at a dinner party, and this gentleman was a huge buyer of art, very wealthy man, had bought a lot of art from my friends, and we had just a very elegant dinner, and he was very sophisticated. He was a former member of a bishopric, and at the dinner or afterwards as we were sitting, he made the comment that you can really tell a recovering or a fully recovered Mormon, that's kind of the terminology that they used, a recovering Mormon, if they're able to divulge their temple name without feeling guilt. One of my closest friends was there, and he knew that that I'd been through the temple. Some of the people there had been through the temple, others hadn't, and I think most of the people there were either married to members or one-time members. But my friend kind of said, well, let's test this theory. Let's see. And because I happen to know this guy's been through the temple right here, and pointed to me, and I was just, I remember just kind of putting my hand and kind of scratching my head and just saying, I've forgotten that long ago. Because this has been several years since I'd been to the temple, and of course I hadn't. I remember thinking, just having this little philosophical moment with myself, that, you know, if I'm working from the premise that the church isn't true, then it's a silly word that shouldn't make any difference if I were to divulge it, to talk about it, to tell people what it was. And I remember suddenly saying, well, you know what, I guess I just remembered it. And, I told them what the name was. And I remember the rest of the evening just kind of feeling I didn't really feel the same. I kind of had a little bit of a somber, maybe attitude about the whole night. And, I left early. I went in my car, and I wasn't quite sober, so I had to sit there for a while, and I just looked out the window, and I just had this moment where I kind of was like, what in the world are you doing? I think just over the several years, the negative experiences were sort of piling up on each other and starting to weigh me down. I certainly felt it that night. I wasn't doing very good spiritually, and the experiment that I had sort of set forth was failing as to whether I could be the type of person that I wanted to be without the gospel.
I know it sounds like a really negative story, but knowing what comes next in your journey, I think that the telling of that is beautiful, because it shares the real low before the turnaround comes. Matt, was that your lowest point as you kind of made your way out of the church?
Yeah, it was. It definitely was. That was the lowest point.
That concludes part one of our interview with Matt Frankham. Please tune in to part two to hear of Matt's return to faith. Thank you for listening to the Mormon Faircast. If there is an issue that you've been wondering about, you can often find the latest answers at the Fair Mormon Wiki, found at fairmormon.org. If you can't find your answer there, feel free to pose your question to the Fair Mormon Apologist by visiting the Fair Mormon contact page. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help us increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Chris Rice. The opinions expressed in the podcast are not necessarily the views of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of Fair Mormon.
Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love. Here I raise my Ebenezer, here by thy great help I've come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God. He to rescue me from danger interposed his precious blood. Precious blood. Oh, that day when freed from sinning, I shall see thy lovely face. clothed then in blood-washed linen. How I'll sing thy sovereign grace. Come, my Lord, no longer tarry. Take my ransom soul away. Send thine angels now to carry me to realms of endless day. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I am constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above.